Should we have raised taxes on alcohol when the government gave these cash payments during the COVID crisis to minimize the damage?
Other countries, and I use their experience with alcohol taxes. Gorbachev had increased the alcohol tax and Yeltsin had cut it, and the deaths moved right along with that. Finland had also cut their alcohol tax and they had a bunch of deaths come on. So it's something to consider. My job is just to say what the consequences are of these things, and it's our elected leaders who need to weigh the choices, but they need to know what the consequences of different choices are, and that's my job.
Alcohol use increased during the pandemic and likely changed behavior for the short and long term. It will have consequences in the years ahead for sure. How do you think about a broad increase in alcohol use as one of the problems of a lockdown and social isolation?
This is a human capital type of issue, and being addictive to a harmful substance is a loss of human capital. And it's one of those legacies of the pandemic that we'll have. Now, one could make the argument, well, it was worth sacrificing the human capital to make ourselves feel better or whatever that may be. But still, as an economist, I can say there will be that long-term consequence, whether it was a good choice or a bad one. That's the way life works. Choices have consequences, even if they were justified choices.
When the government bonus checks were proposed, you predicted that these payments would result in a surge in alcohol and drug deaths. And as a result, you were attacked for these predictions. What was the essence of these attacks?
Well, I'm not a psychologist. I can guess, you know, knowing some of the people, they felt, and I agree, that these policies were well-intentioned. And so anytime you have good intentions and harmful unintended consequences, it can be upsetting. And you'd rather imagine a world that those aren't happening. The sort of people I talk to are not accountable. So if they're wrong, as long as they don't notice, it all feels okay.
Some economists and politicians advocate a negative income tax. Individuals would receive periodic payments from the federal government independent of work effort. One of the consequences of your research is that these proposals will tend to increase access to alcohol and drugs, resulting in more deaths. Why don't people worry about the negative consequences of government payments replacing work?
Doesn't get talked about a lot. Before this pandemic, we had studies, and it was found the key issue was because none of these programs happen in isolation. When the government's cutting the checks for the people, what are kind of the strings attached? Are they encouraged to get engaged with work or the opposite? And a lot of the programs that have happened historically were encouraging people to engage with work, so you didn't see these kind of effects. Another issue would be that the United States is different in terms of especially drug problems and the prevalence of them. And something then that might work in Norway might have a very different effect here because the dangerous drugs are a very real option over here.
America has some of the lowest employment participation rates in modern times, and that was true even before COVID. And it was a function potentially of government programs that allowed or encouraged people not to work, but to choose leisure. And that included availability to both alcohol, opioids, and other drugs. Should we consider the consequences and benefits associated with work and the negative consequences associated with certain elements of not working?
Well, we want to recognize that there are complements, as we say, they go together. Being not work and the substance use, not on an every person basis, but on an average basis. And the causality, therefore, goes in both directions because they're kind of joined like that. And drugs have gotten a lot cheaper and a lot more available, and that can discourage people from working without any change in fiscal policy. Is that a benefit or a cost? I mean, there's a certain libertarian point of view that would celebrate somebody's opportunity to take these drugs, even if it's they're risking their lives. But certainly there are family members and a lot of people upset. I mean, that's part of where 2016 came from. A lot of people upset at attending these funerals, and they would say, please consider these unintended consequences. We really want them to go away.
Your recently published paper links COVID checks with alcohol and opioid deaths using novel econometric methods. Can you explain how you proved your thesis?
Well, I have a model. Now, In the alcohol case, it's a fairly straightforward demand model. And there we have historical estimates that I mentioned earlier, Finland, Yeltsin, Gorbachev, places in the United States. We have an idea how price translates into alcohol deaths or alcohol consumption measured in gallons. But today we're talking about the deaths. There's also an income piece, which I looked at the amount of income and said, well, let me just suppose that people get all this money and they spend some of it and they spend it on a lot of things, not just alcohol, not just drugs, kind of according to how they bought things before, but they got more money to buy the things that they bought before. Meth is similar, except all the drugs, I have this employment connection. And there, we knew a lot about how money prices affect drugs. That's been studied a lot. And then I said, well, the opportunity cost of not working, that's in addition to the money cost. Not only you have to spend money, but you hurt your ability to make money. So I just translate it. And that's a standard tool, at least since Gary Becker in economics, to think about prices as having these two parts, a money part and a time part. Once I take that step, it's fairly easy because I know how much the bonuses are. I mean, they're $300 and $600. Pretty easy to measure in the world of illegal drugs, where the money prices actually can be quite hard to measure. Now, what's most novel is work that I had done before the pandemic is the opioids have these two organic and synthetic products that are coexisting. A shock to the market we had seen before, and I expected we would see it again, can cause people to switch from the expensive prescriptions, or even heroin by comparison being expensive, to something cheaper like fentanyl, especially fentanyl. And so the shocks kind of get amplified compared to the alcohol and meth cases. Again, we had seen that before. We had seen various policy changes around prescriptions, and then we were surprised, like, oh, gee, these people switched to fentanyl and they end up dying more than they were dying on the prescriptions. And I had a numerical estimate of that from before pandemic, so I used that number as well to apply. This is not an exact science. I'm not using the scalpel here. There's a lot of sensitivity analysis in the paper. And if somebody tells me, Casey, you were off by 20% or on this effect or that effect, it's hard to argue in a number of these elements. While we have five or six different pieces, and some are maybe overestimated, some are underestimated, and maybe the total's not so bad.
Deaths in the United States are up year over year. Our natural tendency is to assume that the increase in deaths relate to COVID. But you're saying that the increased mortality rates could result from changes in behavior caused by the lockdowns or bad government policies.
I mean, there's two parts to that. I mean, a lot of the movement to being at home would have happened anyway. Certainly, we had state governors and counties putting down rules, but a lot of people would have done that anyway. And there would have been deaths, especially alcohol deaths from that anyway. And maybe also the drug deaths too. So it kind of blame on the pandemic. The government can make it better, maybe could warn people, maybe not overhype the dangers so that they're running home in cases when they don't really need to run home, like 20, 25-year-olds maybe didn't need to run home. I would blame that on the pandemic. And one of the things I want to look for in the data going forward is the other countries that didn't have our policies, but obviously had the pandemic, what happened with them? And I think you're going to see alcohol deaths in an awful lot of countries. The drug deaths are, in my view, much more tied to the fiscal policy. Now, you could say, well, we had to have that fiscal policy because of the pandemic, but other countries didn't have that fiscal policy, so we didn't have to. Maybe you decide it's a good choice, and this was just an unfortunate byproduct of ultimately a good choice, but it's a choice that other countries did not make. So I'm not expecting to see elevated drug deaths nearly to the degree, even in percentage terms. I mean, we were already starting from a high base, but in percentage terms, I don't expect 30, 40% increases in drug deaths in other countries. Other countries do have drug deaths, but at a lower level, and I don't expect they increase so much in the pandemic.
Your paper uses loss of years of life as a metric. If a 90-year-old man dies of COVID, the expected loss of life might be a year. If a 20-year-old dies from a drug overdose, then the loss of life might be 70 years or 70 times more. How should we think about loss of life years in public policy terms?
I mean, it's a tricky issue. It happens on both sides. So, and it's not really 20-year-olds that are dying. I think I estimated 33 life years left from the drug deaths compared to the COVID deaths, which were maybe like 8 years. It's in the paper. Now, somebody who's 45 who dies from drugs, maybe they weren't going to live to 75. Maybe they were just going to live to 65. I can see that. But also the 75-year-old who died from COVID, maybe they weren't going to live to 82. They were going to live to 76. So it goes on both sides. I think people have the perception that these dangerous drugs are like instant death, and they are not. There's over 100 people have a substance disorder. And that's the flip side. I mean, the chances of dying in a year are less than 1 in 100. So the life expectancy of someone using these dangerous drugs is pretty long. The drug's probably not going to kill them in the next 20 years. It's just that there's so many people using these drugs. And one out of 200 chance of dying is not a chance I want my children taking or I would have taken for myself. That, as occupations go, that's probably a bit more dangerous than being a commercial fisherman. But still, it's not an instant death. And you hear stories like, oh, so-and-so took drugs for the first time in their life and they dropped dead. I mean, that there's enough people taking drugs that that happens every once in a while, enough to make it in the newspaper, but that's not, I don't think, what the data show us.
How have other economists reacted to your COVID and drugs paper?
Well, I was kind of pessimistic, although the president of the NBER had me make a video yesterday about it. He's very excited about the paper, which very much surprised me, because a lot of them were cheering for the bonuses and were upset with me when I said that this might be a side effect of it. My profession is very much moved to become what I call causality police. They don't want to talk about something and unless it's a postmortem. I mean, in this case, literally, they want to see a smoking gun that proves that whatever hypothesis is actually guilty or the real cause. And that's going to take decades. I think the circumstantial evidence is strong. I think we all are Bayesians when we really want to make a decision in life. But the Bayesian approach is not the vogue in my profession.
And why is that?
I mean, we've made some technological advances that people are excited about, and they're kind of, their vision is a little bit narrow because that's where the progress is. And the progress is a good thing, but sometimes you lose sight of the rest of the landscape.
Let me explain what Casey meant by we are all Bayesians. Thomas Bay in the 1700s was a mathematician who created a formula that incorporated your own personal predictions in the model. You have your own predictive value, and then after seeing some results, you then adjust your probability estimate from there. Let me give you an example. Let's say you live in Miami Beach and you want to estimate the high temperature tomorrow to figure out what kind of clothes to wear. And your guess is 80 degrees. And then in fact, the high temperature comes out to be 68 degrees. And then for your estimate for tomorrow's high temperature, you would adjust your guess for tomorrow's high to be just 77 degrees. And the relevance of Bayes to this discussion is that Casey made a prediction that if you give money to someone who just left their job and is an occasional drug user, he expected them to buy more drugs and that some of them would die. In contrast, other economists in his field would be agnostic about the relationship, and they would want to set up experiments to figure out if there was any relationship between having more money and mortality due to increased drug use. Now, it makes a big difference in experimental design and analysis if you start with the working assumption how the world works. The reality is that that's exactly how all of us interact with the world. My next question for QKC is causality. How can we be sure that there wasn't something else going on that could cause the increase in fentanyl deaths? Like, let's say the police were too scared to bust drug dealers because of COVID, and that was the true factor.
I mean, it's a great question. Certainly, if there was just one spike in April, it'd be like, well, a lot of things happened in April. When you get the second spike in January, now we're starting to wonder. We had the red and blue states change their unemployment benefits at different times. It'd be interesting to see how that plays out. Now, the data I only have is through June 2021, so we can't do that. But in 6 months or a year, we can make that sort of comparison in principle.
The psychologist Jeremy Clorfine was on What Happens Next. And he highlighted that during COVID, that in-person therapy for drugs and AA were closed, and that this loss of in-person therapy caused lapses and drug deaths.
I mean, that's the thing I would take seriously. I had a paper over a year ago where I said, you know, lots changed with supply and demand, and we're going to need to be worried. And one of the things is people are being alone. It could be just simply they're not there to call 911. Because again, these things aren't instant death. You have some kind of acute situation. You're not dead immediately. And if you're with somebody, you might be saved. People are trying to kick the habit, and it helps to have companionship to be successful there. So it could have been a very big factor. I don't know quite how to measure it yet. You know, maybe different states would have been different in terms of allowing people in that profession to engage with each other again.
Casey, you presented on What Happens Next 4 times. One of the reasons that I keep having you back on the program is that you are a very creative economist. You choose very important and controversial topics and then apply innovative methods to underutilized data sets. Tell us the interesting things that you did in this paper.
For each one that dies, there's over 100 who are using. And so there's potential for a lot more and sharper data on consumption. Now, when it's illegal, it can be tough, although law enforcement data can be helpful there. I like to have data on the law enforcement activities. I mean, I live in a county where they don't put people in jail anymore or prison. And has that been a factor? That's a pretty different story than I told in the paper. But we know, for example, in these data that the increase, and this was coming before the pandemic, the increase for Blacks is very different than for whites. Is that because they're in cities that don't really put people in prison anymore and the drugs are much cheaper and more available? I don't know, but these are the sort of things to investigate. I do know some MDs who are looking at data on prescriptions. That's a legal market. And they told me they're finding quite a bit more opioid prescriptions. Was it opioids or benzodiazepines, which are often used with opioids? I don't remember which they were finding, but that's an example of the type of study that can be done. And then you can get some pretty reliable numbers in those sort of areas. You can sense that, pay a lot of attention to the measurement here, because when you're dealing with potentially illegal products, it's a big concern. Often what we do is driven by our ability to measure.
Were there differences across races related to drug deaths for COVID checks?
I haven't looked at that super thoroughly. It was pretty similar. It's just that the Blacks had this higher trend, especially on opioids. Blacks were not having opioid deaths for many years. People say, well, that's because they didn't have prescriptions, and they talk about why don't Blacks have prescriptions? Interesting topic. But once fentanyl came into the markets in a permanent way, which is more or less 2015, 2014, the narcotics deaths among Blacks started growing like crazy, and it passed the whites in 2019. And it's continued at a faster pace. Dynamics and the differences by gender and stuff, I don't see that much difference, but it's not something I studied exhaustively. And it's a little tricky because, you know, Blacks are, I don't know, 13 or 14% of the population. So there's that much less data for them. It tends to be a little noisy for some of these questions.
Angus Deaton won the Nobel Prize for Economics for his work related to the declining life expectancy of white men related to drug deaths caused by opioids. And you seem to be saying that these drugs are hurting African-Americans in a bigger way. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it already happened when they were put that book in press. Like I said, they were from between 2015 and 2019, a lot more deaths among Blacks. They had reached par with the whites by that point, and then it's gone past. So that was maybe not good timing on their part. It was a nice story for many years, but not anymore.
What government policies can reduce drug deaths?
One thing I was urging for in the White House, had a lot of trouble, I'm afraid, was just for the government to think about, well, what is it doing to add to the problem? Because you would think in principle the government could control itself, but neither Democrats or Republicans are all that interested in that. They would rather blame pharma companies. Maybe a political entrepreneur could figure out how to do it, because we still subsidize prescriptions. The doctors and hospitals realize if they sent home a nice big bottle of OxyContin that they would get a bigger bonus from the federal government. And they obliged and did it. And we only got rid of that in 2019. And CMS, the agency in charge of that, went kicking and screaming. Trump had to force them to do that. And they said, no, we don't need to do this. There's no reason to think that prescribing blah, blah, blah. So we subsidized benzodiazepines, which people like them with opioids. In fact, anesthesiologists, if you have a surgery, a totally legitimate surgery in a legitimate hospital, probably they're going to give you fentanyl and a benzodiazepine, because it makes the fentanyl work better. And the recreational users know this. And Obamacare, for the first time in our history, began subsidizing benzodiazepines. Medicaid, they knew that they were abusive and abuse potential there, and they refused to cover them. But no, Obamacare, we have to cover everything. So they covered that can be reversed. Obamacare could be repealed altogether. If it did, that would go with it. But certainly that part of Obamacare should be considered, because there you're subsidizing fentanyl because it's something people use with fentanyl. Emptying the prisons has consequences. Again, it's not for me to weigh, but I think we'll want to recognize that maybe the reason we have so much fentanyl is because, is it just a coincidence that within months of ending the federal war on drugs, as Obama and Holder put it, that fentanyl came in our country to stay? It had been in our country dozens of times before, going back to the 70s, and that DEA always found it and beat it back, put the people in prison. Then they changed the sentencing policy, and within months, we have fentanyl in our country in a very big way. Actually, at the same time in 2014, Sweden got fentanyl in their country, and they escalated their war on drugs, and they beat it out. So this is, again, there's more questions than answers, but the questions need to be raised. And I haven't heard anybody raise the question of, you know, it's a drug problem, one of these unintended side effects of incarceration justice, or whatever they call it, criminal justice.
How can we improve the war on drugs?
I'm a big fan of innovation and trying things. And some of the states out west are trying safe injection sites. And I'm very skeptical, but I believe you ought to try, even an idea that seems bad. I mean, innovation is needed here.
Casey, I end each episode on a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about?
Innovation. We've had a lot of health problems historically, waterborne diseases, polio, COVID itself, AIDS. They seemed pretty intimidating at the time. And innovation maybe didn't totally solve the problem, but they made the problem a lot more manageable. And so I'm optimistic that medical innovation will help in this area too.
Casey, thank you so much for your remarks.